You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, as you have probably guessed, all of the broadcasts of the Hour of the Time last week were reruns. And that is because I took a trip. And I took a trip, and I'm going to tell you all about it tonight. It was interesting, to say the least. It was eventful. It was illuminating, so to speak, and the actual getting there and getting back was probably the worst experience we've had in an awful long time. So don't go away. I'll be right back to tell you about our trip to Lansing, Michigan, to protest the raising of the United Nations flag over the Capitol of the state of Michigan, where I was one of the featured guest speakers.
You might sound like green to her,
but suppose she likes Rudy Fowler.
Several weeks ago, ladies and gentlemen, I received a call from Connie Clark in Michigan, and she wanted to know if I would like to be a guest at the protest of the raising of the United Nations flag over the state capitol in Lansing. And those of you who know me know that I jumped at the chance, because I certainly oppose such things. And I was invited to speak on the steps of the state capitol, either before or after the flag-raising ceremony, and I actually spoke afterward, and later at the auditorium of the Lansing Community College, where there was quite a gathering of people to listen to all of us who came to try and impart some wisdom to them. Gene Schroeder was there, It was good to see Gene again. He's a good friend of mine. And Charles Collins was there. Mr. Collier, who wrote Vote Scam, was there. And several other prominent people. We almost didn't even get started because we had car trouble, quite a bit of car trouble, as a matter of fact. The old Bronco, when it's running, looks, and I'm not joking at all, it looks and drives and sounds and acts just like a brand new Bronco, but it's got 145,000 miles on it, and so it's at that stage that even with the fantastic technology that they have today, things are beginning to stop working. And so it's just one right after another. And if it keeps happening, I figure in about 3 months we'll have a brand new Bronco without buying a brand new Bronco. It has served us well and probably will continue to do so for many more years, because we take very good care of it. So when Connie called, I guess it was Thursday or Friday, before the week we were supposed to be in Michigan, and I told her we were having severe problems of the Bronco kind, Connie was very upset, and even offered to rent a car for us. I told her no, that I would let her know whether or not we could fix this problem and get on the road, and we were able to fix it, and of course we were able to get on the road. But I think for those of you who have been listening to this broadcast for some time, you remember, oh, maybe a month ago, maybe a little over a month ago, a month and a half ago, I told you that this winter was going to be an early winter and it was going to be bitter cold. It wasn't a guess. I just made that as a flat statement. I knew it was going to be. And once again, folks, God's not whispering in my ear and I don't have a crystal ball. I have a friend of mine who knows quite a bit about trees, and he happened to reveal to me that the weeping willows were closing their leaves. I said, closing their leaves? What are you talking about? He said, the weeping willows are closing their leaves, and that means it's going to be a terribly long and cold winter. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, I've been around willow trees all my life. And willow trees are the first trees that know when winter is coming. I said, oh, really? So, you know me, I don't believe anything unless I check it out. So I called some nurseries all over the country and asked them if they had any weeping willows or if they had any weeping willows nearby. And if they would check and tell me the condition of the tree and the ones that thought that I was crazy sloughed me off, and the ones who were nice and decent people went and checked their willow trees and told me that they were closing their leaves. And so I called a couple of other people, and then the Old Farmer's Almanac, where there were some people there who had kept track of old wives' tales and how they used to tell the weather many years ago. And sure enough, in their records was a little blurb about if the weeping willows close their leaves, winter will be early and bitter cold. And so when I made that statement, it was not off the top of my head. It was after quite a bit of research and telephone calls and investigation. And sure enough, when we started our trip to Michigan, ladies and gentlemen, we ran into terrible, terrible snowstorms all across the state of New Mexico and up in Kansas. Every single inch of our trip was plagued with black ice on the roads, bitter cold, snow, blinding snow, trees falling across the road, lightning in Kansas, terrible lightning in a snowstorm, and I'd never seen that before in my life. Never in my life have I witnessed lightning in a snowstorm. That's not to say that it doesn't do that. I had just never seen it. And it took us 3 days to reach Lansing, Michigan. The first two-thirds of the trip plagued by bitter cold, snow, ice, sleet, blinding, wind-driven snow in the headlights at night is extremely dangerous, especially on major highways when you have big trucks barreling along at 70 miles an hour and they don't seem to care that they can't see, and you know that you're in front of them. That will give you a severe case of paranoia, I guarantee, especially when you have your wife and two young daughters in the car with you. And the last third of the trip was spent in drenching downpour, rain, blinding rain. And we finally pulled into Lansing, Michigan, to the hotel where we were supposed to stay, the Lansing Sheraton, at just before midnight, I guess. Connie was waiting, along with a representative of the Michigan militia, fearful that we were not going to make it, as she had noticed on the weather reports what we were driving through the whole distance. And I had called and left messages for her a couple of times, telling her the road conditions that we were experiencing and not really knowing if we were going to be there on time or not. We sat and I apologized profusely for being so late, for tomorrow morning was when all of this was to take place, and Connie said, "Never mind."
Fancy driving, wanna see a guy who's driving in love. I'll be satisfied, electrified, to know a guy what takes time.
And about that time, Annie showed up to drag me to my room and put me to bed, where I stayed until bright and early in the morning, and was rudely awakened by Connie again calling to make sure that I did not oversleep, knowing that I was exhausted from this drive. And so I drug myself out of bed and took a bath and cleaned up and dressed and went down to the little restaurant in the hotel and had a quick breakfast. And then we were off to the Capitol. And, oh, what a sight it was. We drove down, and of course, it was overcast in Michigan, and I've never been to Michigan and seen the sun. It's just never happened. And people who live there tell me it's never going to happen, as long as I insist upon coming in October. Or November, or December. They tell me that the sun just does not shine during those months in Michigan. It was overcast, and initially it was raining in the morning, and I knew that, or I felt, I should say, there would be a terrible turnout, for this was to take place on the Capitol grounds, and I was to do my speaking along with Gene Schroeder and others from the Capitol steps. And I figured that most people would get up in the morning and look outside and see this dismal day and the rain falling and would utter a few expletives, roll over, and go back to sleep. But that didn't happen. For some strange reason, the people in Michigan are highly motivated. And when Connie dropped me off at the state capitol, I looked across the expanse of the grounds and I could see what appeared to me to be several hundred American flags being waved about in the air. And I'm not talking about these little flags that you see passed out along parade routes. I'm talking about full-size, large American flags. It was a sight to behold. It was beautiful. It was inspiring, to say the least. And I was duly inspired, and my spirits were uplifted, and I felt a spring in my step, and I set off across those grounds to become a part of what was happening over there. When I arrived at the foot of the Capitol steps, I found approximately 300 people. All of them, it seemed, had American flags, large American flags. Children had smaller American flags, but everybody had American flags. I should say flags of the United States of America, because I've just discovered recently that people who live in Canada and Ecuador and Mexico don't know what you're talking about when you say American flag, because they consider themselves to be Americans and their flags American flags. But it was indeed an inspiring sight to behold. It was uplifting. It was thrilling, to tell you the truth. There was quite a turnout of the Michigan militia, and there were people of all types and sizes and economic stability or instability, as the case may be. There were people in suits and ties and people also who looked like they had not shaved nor changed clothes for several days, and everything in between. And as inconspicuous as they had tried to be, there was the local contingent from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms who stood out like sore thumbs. There were people passing out every kind of conceivable patriot literature and bumper stickers, and someone had erected a pole and hung William Clinton in effigy, and that was the main attraction, it seems, for the local television affiliates, who all had to get their few seconds of William Clinton hung in effigy at the protest meeting against the raising of the United Nations flag over the state capitol in Lansing, Michigan. The press was well represented, most patriots having learned their lesson, refused to grant interviews, because we all know what they do with taped interviews. Doesn't matter how logical or reasonable you are, or what you say, or how nice you are, or how intelligent you are, or whether you're right or wrong, by the time they get through editing that tape, you look like the latest escapee from the most radical, dangerous mental institution in the world. So patriots do not, as a rule, grant interviews that are taped. And that should be a rule for everyone, not just patriots. For the media have no ethics, no morals. They have no conscience. They are liars and deceivers and manipulators and sensationalists. And they are promoting an agenda. If you do not go along with their agenda, they will make you look like the most terrible, worst, insane, blithering idiot that was ever born upon this earth. And they were everywhere, television and print media, trying to talk to someone, and of course no one would talk to them except the city officials and the police. On the state capitol grounds, I saw only two state police officers, and I'm not sure that they're not there all the time. They were there by the doors, and they mainly just checked people for weapons when they went in and out of the state house. They didn't bother anyone. They were nice and polite, well-mannered young men who did their job and didn't hassle anybody. In fact, I kind of liked them, to tell you the truth. And that's the way it should be with police and citizens. Across the street, however, where the flagpole stood and where the mayor's offices were, was a phalange of Nazi jackbooted, storm-trooping teenage ninja idiots, all decked out in riot gear and lined up to protect the flagpole and the United Nations flag against the ravenous United States citizens who had come to protest the raising of that flag over the sovereign soil of the United States of America and the sovereign state of Michigan. Now that was a sight. If you've never seen anything like it before, ladies and gentlemen, all you have to do is get out your videotapes of the old Nazi regime and watch the Nazi SS, the brown shirts, and the Gestapo in action. And that is exactly what we were witnessing in Lansing, Michigan. Last year, they had snipers along the rooftops, and so many people raised so much cane about that episode that I looked in vain to see snipers on the rooftops, but I did see one open window, the only open window on any of the buildings around, at the very tip top of a brick building across the street from the flagpole, from which one solitary rifle barrel protruded. And I made known to others where that solitary sniper was located. And so some took photographs. The morning was spent listening to speakers on education. One woman gave a speech on outcome-based education that was, in my estimation, one of the best I've ever heard. They had the usual trooping of the preachers and those who said prayers and railed against the devil and everything else. And they had some representatives of the Michigan militia who talked. Everybody in the crowd was respectful and listened to everyone who talked. And about an hour after I had arrived, I ran into Gene Schroeder, and we set out to try to find some coffee and never did. That was our main goal that morning, to get a cup of coffee. And a cup of coffee was not to be had at all anywhere. So Gene looked into his little pack there, and we sat down and ate a can of beans.
When you're out on the range and some extremes, a smart fella gobbles the beans.
Jeez, pork and beans.
If you come to start to rumble, well, you know what that means. It's time to gobble the beans.
Jeez, pork and beans.
Actually, we didn't do that. But I think we would have if we had a can of pork and beans, jeans or otherwise. But the coffee was the big item that we all missed. We noticed a little commotion behind us. Now, we were up right next to the Capitol stairs, next to the entrance where this police officer was standing. And behind us, there was a sidewalk that went way, way down across the Capitol grounds to a street where actually Connie had dropped me off, and I had walked across that expanse. We heard what sounded like someone yelling and turned around. There were these two young people, scared to death, terrified. They were terrified. You could see it in their eyes. They were communists. Young, very young communists. Probably young college students. One of them had a ski mask over his face, and the only thing that showed was his eyes, and he was terrified. The other one held a sign with the hammer and sickle and the pro-UN, anti-patriot militia slogans on it. And one was talking through a little portable megaphone, and the other one was holding the sign, and they were sort of walking very slowly toward this crowd of people with flags and militia members dressed in camouflage gear. And I got to tell you, I had a tremendous admiration for those two young people. Not for their political beliefs, for they are seriously misled. Seriously misled in their political ideology. But they had courage well beyond their years. And I forgot to tell you that one was a girl. Just the two of them all alone. Scared out of their minds. Nevertheless, they had enough courage to do this. And some people from the crowd, not the kind of people that normally do much thinking, started rushing up to them, threatening them, and making like they were going to do them some physical harm. However, the leadership of the event materialized, and cooler heads prevailed, and the two young communists were convinced to go stand across the street on the street corner and protest over there. And they did. And I, knowing what courage is and how hard it is to come by, was thinking to myself, what a wonderful asset those two young people would be if somebody could just show them how wrong they were in their support of communism. It's so easy to go wrong when you're young. It is so easy to buy into this craziness, the promise of some utopian world, ignoring the entire history of the human race and the foibles of humanity, which tells any thinking, reasonable, intelligent person that that's never going to happen. And every attempt in the history of the world is met with failure. What it ultimately boils down to is a system of forced enslavement where the people pretend to work and the state pretends to pay them. Nothing is in abundance. The most seriously lacking is dignity and happiness, self-respect, opportunity, knowledge. Truth does not exist in such regimes. I thought about those two quite a bit, as a matter of fact. I admire courage in anyone, and they certainly displayed a great amount of courage. Not long after that, we were all asked to go across the street. Color guard. And the color guard, of course, was supposed to go first, but there were so many flags, ladies and gentlemen, you couldn't tell who was the color guard and who wasn't, so it really didn't make any difference. Everyone had a flag. And everyone was holding that flag up, and there were many people who were standing at attention with their flags like they were the color guard, and so I never really did know who was and who wasn't. And when the Nazi jackbooted teenage ninja turtle thugs across the street in their bright and shiny Gestapo gear, and they really did have jackboots on, I'm not joking there, and their shields and their helmets with their face visors and their billy clubs and their pistols, it was amazing to fend off a bunch of just ordinary folk who had come to voice their displeasure at the raising of the United Nations flag. It was amazing. I was amazed. And so when we started across the street, you could feel the tenseness in the air. And you could see the police officers fidgeting. And then the Air Force arrived. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a solitary airplane of the Air Force of the militia, towing a banner that had to be a half a mile long that said, "Just say no to the UN." And everybody started clapping, and yeah, all right, look in the air, and they all pointed at you. And the mood changed. Even the police officers were looking up. It was a wonderful sight to behold. And for a few moments, all the tenseness went away, and everybody was laughing and cheering and having a good old time. It was a lot of fun. And that's about the time that I spotted the sniper up in the window and began to alert some of the others. And we looked up and saw a huge TV video monitor on the roof of the building, spinning around slowly and pointing down and videotaping all of the faces in the crowd. And all that I had read in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and in 1994 came to mind. And there was no doubt about it, ladies and gentlemen. We were no longer in a free country where things of this nature travel to us in the newspapers and on the airwaves about events that happened in other countries. It was happening right there in Lansing, Michigan, right before my eyes. Right before my eyes. And then some obviously federal agents began to move through the crowd taking pictures of people. Can you imagine this? You see, this is what we had been taught could only happen in a Hitler's Germany or a Stalin's Russia or in Castro's Cuba. Not so. It was happening and happens every day in the United States of America. And most people don't even realize it. Most of you still haven't spotted the television surveillance cameras along the freeways, the major intersections of highways yet, that follow your every move and record the license plate number of every automobile that passes. And you wonder how they caught Timothy McVeigh so quick, speeding out of Oklahoma City in a yellow Mercury with no license plate. That's just supposition, ladies and gentlemen, because I do not know for sure if a surveillance camera was involved in that or not. I suspect many were, knowing what I know about what happened in Oklahoma City. But that's for another night. The mood then began to get ugly again. People were disappointed. They were saddened. They were angered by what was happening, by the sniper rifle barrel sticking out of the window aimed at the crowd, by the videotaping, by the surveillance cameras, by the federal agents taking photographs of people in the crowd, by the Nazi jackbooted teenage ninja thugs wearing all of their riot gear for no reason whatsoever. No one had threatened violence. No one was violent. No one was carrying weapons. Children were there with mothers and fathers. It was a family event. No one had been provoked. There was no reason for it whatsoever. And these weren't just your usual jackbooted Nazi teenage ninja turtle thugs. Some of them had looks of shame on their face. Obviously did not want to be there, did not like the role in which they had been cast. Some were extremely nervous and could have actually injured someone for no reason whatsoever. I said a silent prayer that no one would set off a firecracker in the crowd, watching those nervous police officers, men and women, nervous, fidgeting, with the butt of the pistol they wore in the holster on their hip, as if indecisive whether they should have it in the holster or in their hand, and not really wanting that hand to be too far away from that pistol in case they had to yank it out and use it. And I wasn't the only one that noticed these things. People in the crowd began to tell them that they should be ashamed of themselves. "You should be ashamed of yourself," one woman screamed in the face of one of these big, young, husky men who lowered his eyes and looked very sheepish indeed, as if he was ashamed of himself. I heard some people walk up and tell them, you know, you should see yourself. You're a traitor. You're violating your oath to protect and defend the Constitution for the United States of America. And I knew that they were spitting in the wind, so to speak, because I knew that not one single one of those police officers had ever read the Constitution in their entire life. Any more than most young men who had gone in and taken the oath of allegiance when they joined the military, whether it be the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or Coast Guard, and raised their hand and took the oath to support, protect, and defend the Constitution for the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic, they never read it either. I knew this. I knew that most of the people in that crowd who had come to protest the raising of that flag had read it. Not only had read it, but had a copy of it on their person and normally carried a copy with it wherever they go. On their person, as I do, always. Because we love it. We know, as most others do not know, that that document is the government. Bill Clinton isn't the government. Bill Clinton is the chief executive officer who takes an oath to protect and defend that document, which is really the government. And in his duties, he is supposed to always have that foremost in his thoughts and actions. The Congress is not the government. The Congress represents that document, fulfills its purpose as outlined in that document when it's operating within the bounds of the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution. You see, that's what we know. So I ask some of those people not to be too hard on those police officers, knowing that they had never read the Constitution and therefore did not know what they were doing, any more than those young men in Nazi Germany who put on the SS uniform and did what they were told because they were ordered to do it, knew what they were doing. Any more than they knew that they were going to get away with using, "I was just following orders," as an excuse. Nuremberg did away with that forever. And then, all of a sudden, ladies and gentlemen, something extraordinary happened. I could not believe my eyes. I really could not. Because right in front of my eyes, all of a sudden, the doors to this building flew open. And out ran a squad, another squad, of Nazi jackbooted teenage Ninja Turtle thugs. Shields in the air, clubs in their hand, and behind them out walked an Indian chief in full regalia with a war bonnet, and they crowded around him as if he was under some threat. And then out walked this little man in a suit and tie, obviously nervous, with a nervous grin on his face and a little tick in his eye, and his hands were shaking, and I knew that had to be the mayor. That had to be the mayor. And this squad of Nazi jackbooted teenage Ninja Turtle thugs formed a circle around these people and marched them up to the flagpole, much as you see the Roman legions in their turtle formations marching upon a battlefield in ancient Rome. And then they unfurled the flag of the United States, placed the United Nations flag under it, up the pole it went. Accompanied simultaneously by 300 boos. The boos continued for about 10 or 15 minutes, along with calls of, "You should be ashamed of yourself. Have you read your oath? You're in violation of your oath of office. You're violating the Constitution. You shouldn't be doing this. We're not a vassal state of the United Nations. Down with the United Nations. Just say no to the United Nations." 300 people all doing this at once. Traffic stopped. People gawking, looking. Across the street, a man held up a sign, said, "Say no to the militia, say no to the UN. He didn't understand without the militia you can't say no to the UN. Not when you have a subversive group of people in control of government. The little nervous mayor and this man in Indian costume, surrounded by this phalanx of police in their turtle formation, walked backwards into the building and disappeared. The police left outside, facing this upset crowd. It was not an angry crowd, but they were definitely upset. Began to fidget even more, and I heard one police woman, I guess she was a sergeant, telling them to stay alert and watch their backs. And I burst out laughing. I just had to burst out laughing, ladies and gentlemen. And I looked her right in the eye, and a magical thing happened. I laughed and I struck up a conversation with her, and all of a sudden she just became another girl. Then we just talked. And everybody looked up again and watched the plane circling with the banner that said, "Just say no to the UN," fly around and cheered some more, and then went back across the street. And back across the street, it was time for some music, and so somebody played some music. Everybody sort of relaxed because the focus of the attention and the cause of the creation of the tension that had been building all that morning was over. It was all done with. The flag was flying. The Nazi jackbooted teenage Ninja Turtle thugs were all there by themselves, and so they felt relieved. They weren't going to get killed after all. And we were all happy that we had protested the raising of the flag, and now we were going to get down to some serious speech making and some talking and all of that kind of thing. And we did. We did. And so everybody took turns having their say, speaking and carrying on. And it sort of actually sounded like this. Separate ways to meet again at 1 o'clock at the auditorium of the Lansing Community College, where people set up tables and offered Patriot things for sale, and we all got to just sort of relax and talk to each other as people. And Gene and I finally set out on an expedition to get a cup of coffee, and we actually found one in the student cafeteria where we got the biggest cups we could find, filled them to the brim, and amidst some very happy and congenial conversation, we walked back to the auditorium drinking our treasure of the day. That was our treasure, finding that cup of coffee. And we needed it, too. Went back, and Gene was the first speaker of the day, I believe. And he gave an excellent talk. And then we all just followed in line. In the meantime, I was minding my own business, and every time I would look around, ladies and gentlemen, I would see someone peeking at me from around a corner, or behind a chair, looking at me down the stairwell. And then, all of a sudden, I saw this person duck in to the auditorium, and Connie Clark, having been watching him all the time, ran up the stairs and opened the door and made him come back out and grabbed him by his ear and took him down to the table and chastised him for trying to sneak into the auditorium without paying admission. And made Mr. Cornkey pay like everybody else. And his sidekick, Mr. Stadmiller, who true to form, were trying to pull another scam on everybody and get in without paying. And then I went to the bathroom. All this time they had been sneaking around, peeking at me from behind doors and around corners. And I'd seen Cornkey on video before, but I didn't really pay any attention to who he was and didn't recognize him, to tell you the truth. And guess what? They didn't have the guts to speak to me anywhere except in the bathroom. I went in the bathroom, I'm standing there doing my business, and all of a sudden the doors fly open and it's Cornkey, son of Gork, and his sidekick Stadmiller, who come in and pretend like they're combing their hair. Say, "Oh, that looks like Mr. Cooper over there. Mr. Cooper, this is Mr. Cornkey. About time you guys got together. Would you like to speak to Mr. Cornkey?" I looked them both right in the eye, told Mark Cornkey right to his face, that he was a phony, lying provocateur, told him that when he had first contacted me and said that he was an Air Force officer on active duty working for the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, and asked him to produce documentation, that then I wanted to talk to him. And since he has never produced any documentation to anyone about who he really is, I said, no, Mr. Kornke, and no, Mr. Stadmiller, I do not want to talk to either one of you ever. I washed my hands and walked out of the bathroom. And all of the rest of the afternoon, when I saw them, they were skulking at me. Oh, it was an experience, ladies and gentlemen. I wish you could have been there. You probably would have enjoyed it as much as I did. And that was it. It was a memorable day. And the next morning, we all got up, mounted our trusty Bronco, and took off into the rain and the snow again. And when we got home, this place was covered with snow and had been for a week. And it was snowing all day today, and from what I understand, it's supposed to snow all day tomorrow. Early winter, bitter cold. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, and I want to thank Jackie Petru and Chuck and everybody else who took the hint and kept our tradition of calling attention to the flag-raising ceremony of the United Nations flag in Gainesville, Florida, and stirred up a crowd of about 100 people to go down there and do what we were doing in Lansing, Michigan. Thank you very much. I knew you would. And that's why I played that rerun. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless you all. This is the Voice of Freedom. This is WWFN, the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona. Stay tuned for Quest for Help with Michael Cottingham.